chapter that ended in the mid-50s or so.
And when did Woodward die?
Oh, 70s.
Oh, so he really burned himself out.
Yeah. I think 78 or so. I didn't see him any in the last years. Since 1960, we didn't see much of him. He stopped being a consultant and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And got off on these very glamorous things. And, he spent a lot of time in Switzerland and back and forth.
That was a great experience.
Yeah.
For you.
Well, it was a good experience. Hi.
Hi there.
Can I help you anything?
No, I just come back from my therapy.
Okay.
So, let's see. At this point, you explored this YAM, this steroid thing up to the time that YAMs showed that it wasn't going to work. And then I just was curious about management at Monsanto during this period. Mm-hmm. My impression is that after the war, in that period, the people that reached the upper levels of management in the industry were trained in chemistry and were chemists primarily. But then later it evolved to where you got more and more business people to the top, and you didn't have people with sound chemical understanding in the higher levels of management.
Yeah, I think you can say that again. Yes, that's true. Though Edgar Queeny, who was in power all the time, wasn't chemical, but he had him around him a number of people that had chemical backgrounds. And he had Gaston Du Bois, and he had other people, and then Thompson Huckwald had quite a bit of chemical background. But after that, there was none. And I think I ran into that problem later. It's very easy to describe the Nobel thing to anybody who's had any basic chemistry, but if you haven't, it takes a lecture.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
so at this 1950s period, there were still the chemists were more in the...
There were some there. Not all, but there's some.
And so now, but then you elected to go up to what they call a technical ladder, I guess.
I never went up in the administrative ladder at all. In fact, I just didn't want to do that.
So sure.
And I think you'd make more money if you did that.
Oh, yeah.
I know I'd make more money, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. That wasn't primary concern. And I was getting to be a fairly senior man, so I wasn't bothered by a lot of nitpicking little things.
And so you had shown your value to the company, and they had recognized that.
Well, one project, and I don't know the dates of it, that we played with, we were always interested in getting a problem, it was the commercialization or synthesis of chloramphenicol, which was an antibiotic.
Okay.
Chloramphenicol.
C-H-L-O-R.
It's an antibiotic.
M.
Phenicol or chloromycetin, either. I'll give you the other name.
Okay. Very good.
Now, Park Davis had come up with this, and this had two features in it. It was a simple chemical, but it had two features in it that were unique. And then in natural product chemistry, it had a nitro group and a dichloroacetyl group. Well, I got involved. I can't remember. It must have been a little back in the late 40s or something, putting the dichloroacetyl group on. We were using pretty much Park Davis stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was a resolution. Optically active material, and you had to resolve it, and we had to run a resolution and so forth, and others did that, and I put the dichloroacetyl on, and I pride myself, and I was able to shorten the route that Park Davis had considerably on that. It made it much simpler, and it was very easy to put it on, but we made 14,000 pounds of it, and then it had a problem. There was a disease called aplastic anemia, which is pretty damn often fatal. And there were a few cases. I mean, they probably had already millions of prescriptions out there,
mm-hmm.
and there were a few cases of aplastic anemia,
mm-hmm.
and then the other ones, the terramycin and chloromycin came along, and they do pretty much the same thing, so it didn't get banned, but it got very much pushed back, so mm-hmm. we got out of that. Otherwise, we would have probably gone into the manufacture of that for Park Davis again.
Mm-hmm.
And but that is still around, and it's still the best thing for typhoid fever, but who's the last one you ever heard of had typhoid fever? You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still the antibiotic of choice for that. And I've still got a bottle of it in my medicine cabinet. But I had a dog at the time that had some fungus or something that wouldn't cure very easy with the ointments, at least the vet gave me at those times. But I just threw in one of those ointments, mixed the mm-hmm. chloromycin, and then it's gone like that. So I don't know, but it was a very good antibiotic, but it did have, out of a few million cases, two or three cases of aplastic anemia.
Mm.
Well, if you call that a military operation, you consider that enormously successful.
Right.
But you can't tolerate anything, and then there was another material that would do it, so it failed. So that was another one, but it involved making an optically active mm-hmm. compound, chiral compound, that was just by the difficult resolution method.
Mm-hmm. So what other, when did you actually get into the asymmetric hydrogenation?
Well, I didn't get into later. First of all, I went into a kinetic problem in the plant about the late 50s. This was a very simple rubber chemical intermediate. Paranitrophenetol was made into paraphenetidin, which was the rubber chemical. And it was also made into some other things, but that was... It was a key intermediate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by scrutiny of the kinetics, and I didn't even get the kinetics, our analytical lab got that.
Mm-hmm.
It was just scrutiny of the kinetics, we were able to double the production by short reacting and recycling the unreacted back. It was that kind of a study, but we were able to double production without adding much capital,
mm-hmm.
or hardly any capital. So from a point of view of economics, that was much more important than most of the other things I did. And I spent quite a little while on computer programs and things like that, on kinetics of successive second-order reactions, which gets pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd forgotten my math and had to go back and learn it a little bit again. It mm-hmm. was kind of fun. And there was one physical chemist that helped me with the math to get back in. You know, mass the kind of things you're out of it, you've forgotten how you differentiate and all those kind of things. But so I did get involved with kinetics for 2-3 years. And then I think next I got involved with some straight hydrogenations. We were hydrogenating using a nickel catalyst,
mm-hmm.
mostly nitro groups, over at Kremerick plant.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was this paranitrophenetol. They were reducing it to the amine, a nitro group to the amine. And they were using a nickel catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that their source of hydrogen was intermittent. They had cells, caustic cells, and they got hydrogen as a byproduct. And if you shut the hydrogen off, then the catalyst poisoned. Condensation mm-hmm. products covered it up, and you had to recatalyze and start all over again. Mm-hmm. That was a big nuisance. And they were worried about that problem. They had some corrosion problems. Well, my suggestion was very simple. I didn't even I used palladium on carbon.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like nothing now, but anyhow, it was more then.
Mm-hmm.
They used a nickel catalyst, which they actually made or something. And palladium on carbon didn't have these bad properties, but they said, well, palladium is much too expensive. Mm-hmm. And actually, you put less dollars worth of palladium than you did nickel to get the job.
Yeah.
I couldn't get them to do it in the plant. And it wouldn't work in our pilot plant because we'd had so much poisons mm-hmm. in the autoclave there that we could, and you couldn't have anything in that with these heterogeneous catalysts.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that one of our guys found out that England was doing this hydrogenation of nitro.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked them into trying it with palladium and carbon. This is a big plant unit that they'd been doing nickel. And of course it worked just fine. They never did turn back. And so then the nailers all shifted over to it. But it was much cheaper. Even throwing away the palladium, it was cheaper, but you didn't filter it off and send it back for recovery. You never got more than 75% on that.
So the plant in England, was that a Monsanto plant?
It was a Monsanto plant over there, and it was just one of our people that I was talking to said, well, they're trying it. Why don't we talk to them? Maybe they'll do it. Well, they went so conservative and decided to try it.
So the whole idea of using palladium just scared people away because of the
scared them away. Too expensive.
Yeah, without even knowing
but
the,
you didn't need to use very much.
Yeah.
But I couldn't demonstrate that on a pilot plant
right.
scale because you couldn't get by with that little there because of the fact that it was eternally poisoned. And to get the thing clean would have been, I don't know, you'd have to really boil everything in caustic and blah, blah, this and that and so forth. So anyhow, there was a little politics in that. But
it took
a little while in there. The hydrogenation group, which was on that, wouldn't move because they said, we got to solve a corrosion problem. And I said, well, you won't have the corrosion problem if you use this. But we got to solve that first before we can do this. So we went ahead and finally got England to do it.
Kind of did an end run.
That's right. And sometimes it takes that to do that in the plant. But
so even though
I did get involved with that, and I got involved with engineering. I never was an engineer, but I got involved with engineers.
Yeah, it sounds like you're kind of getting in the chemical engineering side of things.
Yeah, well, the kinetic job required putting in a continuous distillation.
Mm.
And I did have a very good rapport with this one engineer named Davis, I think, or something. I don't know what his name is. He just come have lunch with me every day, and we worked it out, and so they were able to throw together. It had to be a continuous recycling back of the unreacted starting material. They were reacting out the starting material, and that was taking them forever. Two or three times as long to get. You get to 90% conversion quickly with successive seven orders, and then it tails off fast.
Sure.
And so we'd go to 90% and recycle the 10 back. And we had a very simple test, though. We had to do recycled material had chlorine in it, so we could run a Beilstein test, and that's what we did with that simple kind of thing. Now the plant would have a fancy equipment and blah, blah, this and that.
Yeah.
This was just, they had a little room with a flame, and the guy would test it, and since the flame was negative, he cut the still off. But we had to do that continuously, and so we ended
just
up
keep it out. Yeah.
He made it right. And this guy put it in and had all the equations for continuous distillation and all this. I got acquainted with that at least, But anyhow, I did get into the hydrogenation using noble metals, and that probably was the first venture toward things that you can use these very expensive metals if you don't use very much of them. And I'm not sure, we always were in dispute as how much palladium we recovered. There's no reason, since it was just a simple filtration, why we wouldn't have recovered more than that. I'm wondering still whether some of that palladium solubilized nitrometal. But we didn't have the analytical devices then to measure that if we did. I speculate now that maybe that was happening.
You're losing some of the catalysts, didn't you?
Well, then this came along about the first thing I think I mentioned in there, that we were always looking for projects to do. One was lysine, which looked like a good project. And there was a pretty good synthesis of lysine, a Japanese synthesis from acrylonitrile. Now we made nylon from acrylonitrile, pseudamine. It's the old thing of building a family tree. It's very easy to make a little bit more acrylonitrile and make lysine, you pseudamine. So that is a good thing for us to do, right? It wouldn't have been interesting at all if we had to buy the acrylonitrile, but we have a big plant making it. We could expand that plant much more cheaply. And so that was a good project to look at. Well, we, of course, got racemic lysine. We wanted the thing. Well, we everything we calculated, you can take the racemate and you take the wrong isomer and racemize it and cycle it back in the system and all that stuff. But you end up with so damn much equipment that you really double your cost, however you look at it. Just couldn't come up. This is all paper chemistry. I did one of our engineers, and we just couldn't come up with anything that, unless you could make the damn thing directly. And we did not do that, and I still don't know how to do that in that particular one. But we do really know how, but not simply. But that so that sort of sat fallow just as a problem. But I didn't do anything. But I didn't have anything to do about it. And then during the 60s. We had a new research director, Costas Anagnostopoulos. That's a tough one. Don't have to bother about that. He's came in, and what he did was decide that I would, as a senior scientist, they called it then, or I don't know, distinguished fellow, I don't know which it was, would get a new man to train. Every time they hired a new PhD, they'd give him to me for a year to train, put him on anything, and he said, I don't want to know what you're doing. And so I figured out another number of exploratory projects. Some of them were exciting. We had one that was to extract a flavoring agent out of larch bark. This is there's a thing, a flavoring agent called maltol, M-A-L-T-O-L. It's a simple cyclic sugar derivative.
You're trying to extract it from what?
The way it came is this. Pfizer was making this now, and it does the same thing to Jell-O products that monosodium glutamate does to meat. Monosodium glutamate gives a media that this gave Jell-O products a special flavor. And I think it's being used today. Strawberry Jell-O, these kind of things, you know. And Pfizer was making it from kojic acid. Well, I don't know whether I'd noticed or one of my people had noticed in Beilstein this damn maltol existed in the bark, in larch bark. Way back, somebody in Beilstein found that out.
This is a tree bark? Or
And so we had learned from our paper operation for the Vanlin that St. Regis had a big larch operation up in northern Montana. This was a glamorous trip, at least. So we went up there, did a little fishing to boot, but went up there and took a look at this place, and they were taking in 50% of their intake with larch trees. This was a tamarisk occidentalis, some kind of a larch that they were doing, and so we got samples of bark.
How do you spell that tree? What?
Larch, L-A-R-C-H. Lark. A larch is a conifer that loses its leaves. It has cones, and just like a regular conifer, but in the winter it loses its leaves, and they're called dead. And the tamarisk is the most worldwide thing. Russia has millions of acres of tamarisk trees. And so we said, well, where they're collecting it, I can't go out and collect it per se, but they're already bringing in debarking these trees. And so that it looked as though there was an opportunity here, and the St. Regis paper people, they said, well, gee, something you can sell for $12 a pound sounds good to us. We'll go ahead and take a look at it. So we went up there and we got the bark and brought it back, and it did contain maltol. And we were able to isolate. It wasn't very hard to isolate out of it, but we did that. We had a, got a lot of bark and chopped it up out of a little shredder in my backyard. I brought it down to the community plant and we shredded it. And then extracted the bark out, and it was as a glycoside. You had to hydrolyze it first. But we got the maltol out, and we got good maltol and so forth. But then it got more complicated later. It wasn't quite that simple because it didn't bring only larch in. And they had a pond in front of the sawmill, and they brought the logs in, and this guy in the boat in the pond pushed the logs in the various places. The valuable logs would go to railroad timbers, the stud logs, the ones that weren't very big, would go to making studs and so forth. And he made the decision, this guy completely uneducated. And so it was just impossible to get him to just only do the latch today. Because they debarked him immediately, and they had this huge pile of bark, which actually they burned for fuel, wasn't much good for fuel, but it was 70% water. But nevertheless, that's what they did with it to get rid of it. But anyhow, it didn't look as though we could really just collect the large bark, and the other bark didn't have any.
So
we ended up not doing much with that. But that was an interesting project. That was a kind of a thing I was on. And a second project which I was on, was which I started, was, I think, one word Simon, when I ever solved it, it was to find a resin system which, when it cured, expanded. You see, I don't mean just made a gas. You can do it with a gas. But it did like ice freezing. And this would be very useful on potting compound, a lot of things. And so what the idea was to generate a coil spring molecule and, say, cross-link an epoxy. We never did get... we could reduce the contraction, but we never did get going the other way. But I'm still thinking if you had a coil spring molecule and then you had it do the thing, it might be bound. It brought the thing together by polymerizing, would be less than the expansion due to it unwrapping. And we found some advantage of taking very flexible cross linkers. They'd be cyclic anhydrides, but they'd be quite flexible, and then you cross link an epoxy, and it wouldn't be, gee, some of them were 10% they shrank, you know, when you secured. We got it down to maybe 5%, 4%, something like that. And that stat that way, I had a publication on that, it's in your list probably, it is somewhere, but I never did anything with that because these other things came along. And then what happened was I read about Wilkinson's discoveries of 66 of tristriphenylphosphine chlororhodium. This is a hydrogenation catalyst that would hydrogenate simple olefins just like the heterogeneous by a homogeneous. And then homogeneous hydrogenation was practically an unknown thing. It was around. There had been one that would reduce quinone to hydroquinone, a copper one back in 39. But generally speaking, that wasn't very effective.
So these were just catalysts for opening up the double bond and
no, for and hydrogenating the double bond.
Hydrogenating a double bond.
But they would, just to make it saturated.
Right.
And but they worked not as a heterogeneous on a surface, they worked in solution.
Okay.
That's the difference.
Okay.
Wilkinson was in solution. He made this discovery, and he got a Nobel Prize, not for that, but he would have gotten it for that. I think he wouldn't have gotten it without that, we'll put it that way. And Wilkinson, Rene Osborne and Wilkinson did this, and I, of course, met Wilkinson, I met Osborne. Osborne said, well, Wilkinson was never there, I really did it. And the chronology, this is interesting because Osborne and Noriari were at Harvard at this time.
How do you spell Osborne?
O-S-B-O-R-N-E.
And Noriari.
Yeah. Osborne and Noriari, who got the Nobel Prize, they were both at Harvard at this time. And familiar with Wilkinson's work. And then I read about Wilkinson's work first in a Welch Foundation lecture that Wilkinson gave. I didn't go to it. And in the discussion afterwards, it was suggested if you you could use, he used triphenylphosphine on a regular olefin. If you used a chirophosphine on an asymmetric phosphine, we'll say on a chiral, on a prochiral olefin, you would get an asymmetric synthesis. See what I mean? And it was decided this would be a good thing to try.
This was in discussion of the
show. It was discussion. And I guess there were, best I can say, there were about five of us that decided this would be a good thing to try. And so we all tried it. And at the same time, it turned out, I mean, most of the people just put some chiral side chain on the phosphine and the triphenylphosphine and let it go it that way. But we thought the we thought the asymmetry would be right on the phosphorus because that was what the business was. So we found out that just at that same time, Mislow and also Horner in Germany and discovered that you could make phosphine. You see, if nitrogen is connected to three different things, you can't resolve it because it racemizes mm-hmm. so readily. That's at room temperature. Mm-hmm. You could resolve it at minus 100 or something like that. But phosphines, they thought might be the same, but they found out that they were stable at room temperature. Oh, I think in 110 degrees, they have a half-life of 2-3 hours or mm-hmm. something. So both Winslow and Horner discovered this. Horner did it with electrochemistry. Winslow did it with pretty confused synthetic chemistry, of which he didn't understand. Mm-hmm. When we had him here, he had to call his student to find out what the hell he did do, and we never did find out very well. But he was interested in running how fast these things racemize different structures. And so his discovery was made just at that time, so we decided we'd make a chiral phosphine, and namely the one that Winslow made, mm-hmm. and try it in this synthesis. So we made the one that Winslow made, which is methyl propyl phenyl phosphine. And that is four different things attached to the phosphorus, the electrons count, and the other three in it, and that's resolvable. And we did get, he never got it completely resolved, and probably we didn't either, but we had pretty good 80 or 90%.
Mm-hmm.
And
so when you say resolve, that means separate out the two...
yes, enantiomers. We need the chiral one.
Right.
And then we use that instead of triphenylphosphine, and we had to choose a what we call a prochiral olefin.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest one we could choose was alpha phenyl acrylic acid. That was a simple one, alpha phenyl acrylic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the main problem was it took 6 months to synthesize the phosphine, because we had all kinds of troubles doing it.
Mm-hmm.
This new guy came in with me, and first of all, the first guy that I wanted to put on this project to make the phosphine said he didn't want to do anything that fancy. I mean, with low chance, so he went to something else. Maybe he went over and did the Larch Park. That's what he did. Went over and did the Larch Park project,
mm-hmm.
which is much more, he was much happier on that. And this other guy, Jerry Sabicki, who mm-hmm. published with me, he just come from Illinois and was very good on NMR, which we weren't, incidentally. I didn't know anybody about NMR, but Illinois had them really trained, their organic mm-hmm. people, they really know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to use his skill on that, because he couldn't have made phosphines without that.
Mm.
And he got in on very stinky hoods. He was very unpopular because he had to start with trimethyl phosphite, which is terrible, and the whole series stunk all the way through. and it took him 5 or 6 months to... Like he said, in January, and was June before he had a phosphine. Mm-hmm. Had methyl propyl phenyl phosphine. This is the one that Mislow had already made,
mm-hmm.
and Horner had already made. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have descriptions of how to make it, really.
Mm.
Horner had some fancy electrochemistry. Mislow didn't ever publish.
Mm-hmm.
He just said he made it.
Mm-hmm.
We knew the sequence of reactions, but we didn't. We had to work them out, same as he did. And so we ran that, and we got a, and Jerry ran it 4 or 5 times to be sure we got a chiral effect. Not much, 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't really done anything that no one else had done. The only substantial effort in this direction had been a Japanese group since 1955 had tried to empirically absorb chiral agents on heterogeneous catalysts and do it that way. And they'd gotten perhaps up to 15%, but
mm-hmm.
it's purely empirical, and they had one good result with palladium on a with a silk fibroin, which they said they couldn't repeat.
Mm.
They said they couldn't repeat it, and we weren't even trying.
Yeah, right.
But that was a heterogeneous catalyst,
mm-hmm.
and we liked this because it was homogeneous,
mm-hmm.
and we had to establish that we were fact homogeneous, and that there wasn't any material plated out on
surface
a reactor
effects,
or
yeah.
something that would cause it. We had to go to some trouble to prove that.
Yeah.
But then we did get that first publication out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was traumatic because patent department doesn't like to hurry, and it's hard to publish an industry, but I kind of knew we had something here and wanted to get a communication out on it.
Yeah, the first paper wasn't worth anything.
Mm-hmm. And so that kept them happy. They weren't disclosing anything that anybody could make a buck out of.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I finally talked them into filing a very poor case, because they really didn't know what to file, so they filed a case about it. And they had to file a case before they let you publish, and I got it published.
Mm-hmm.
And we beat Horner to the draw by a month.
Oh, wow.
And he was a little mad at us. But
so are you saying before you could do the publication, you had to get the patent department to get the patent?
To file a patent.
File.
Yeah, they always have to do that.
Okay.
So they filed it, and so that took from June to September. We did it in June, but we didn't publish. We got a Chem Communications publication out in September.
Okay.
But we were the first, even so, to publish in this field.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I didn't notice at the time, that Hewitt Stalk pointed out much later, he's at Columbia, that he was actually at Harvard at that time. We got to know him. What was his last name? Gilbert Stalk. He's an old-time professor now at Columbia. He was a kind of an associate professor or something at Harvard. They had one, and he didn't get tenure, and so went to Columbia.
Okay. So S-T-O-R-K, Stork?
Yeah, but he mentioned that the main thing is we made the prediction on this original publication that given time, this structure didn't give us more than 15%, but we were very rapidly able to find something that would give acceptable yields.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly everybody says this on their breakthrough publications. Stork mm-hmm. says this is the only one I ever read that it came to pass. It's kind of funny, but
made a prediction, it worked.
Yeah, we made a prediction, but that's what happened. It works much faster than we would have predicted. So what we had to do was to find a phosphine. It was a suitable structure to give us acceptable results.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not doing it impossible because nature can do this with enzymes.
Sure.
But yeah, I wanted to get something far short of the complexity of an enzyme.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, phosphine number 6 was acceptable.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you took and changed the substitutions of phosphine. So the phosphine has the 3 different groups on it.
All right, 3 different groups. We wanted to put some different ones on there. So this is methyl, propyl, phenyl.
Right.
And so we took, we decided that the ortho anacyl group would be good. That has a little steric hindrance, and it will withstand the rigors of
mm-hmm.
the synthesis. Requires Grignard reactions,
mm-hmm.
and Grignard reactions won't just run on anything, they're rather reactive materials.
Mm-hmm.
So the ortho anacyl group looked just great for that. And so we took the ortho anacyl group and made methyl ortho anacyl phenyl phosphine. And that gave fairly good results, I think some 60% or something. So that spurred us on, that's not good enough to be practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took the phenyl and made it into cyclohexyl by hydrogenating it selectively. You actually could do that.
Mm.
And so then we got to methyl ortho anacyl cyclohexyl.
Mm-hmm.
And we jumped to 80%.
Mm.
And actually, this was good enough for lab preps.
Mm-hmm.
We really could get it by low temperatures up to 88, but practically 80. And so that got us very excited. But we couldn't really publish that because the patent department gets a little hairy about it. So we tried. We finally got some communication. One way I got to publish, say something about it, was the fact that Frodol, who was in vice president in charge of research, was talking with the head of what was this magazine called?
CNN News?
Chem News, Chem Week or something.
Oh, okay.
And it was a sort of a little bit of a popularized
mm-hmm.
Chem thing. And so we ended up getting an article in that because I sort of lied and said Throdol wanted us to do that. I told the patent department that. Because this guy wanted to get something.
Yeah.
So I sort of...
So how does his name, spell his name? Throdol?
T-H-R-O-D-A-H-L. He was vice general in charge of research at that time.
T-H-R-O-A-D-E?
T-H-R-O-D-A-H-L, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
And...
So you kind of faked that to get the...
Well, I faked it. We got a little announcement there, but not much. And then the other place that I got to go was to give a talk at the New York Academy of Sciences, which doesn't require much of an abstract, not as demanding as the other places.
Mm-hmm.
And they get out sort of a publication, which isn't as demanding, so I can slip that by the patent department.
So, over this period of time, was this evolution of catalyst? Was that
we wanted to get some publication out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, evolution of catalyst. I could get some of that into these type of places,
mm-hmm.
which aren't normal venues for coming out with. But I would like to be in the JACS or something immediately.
Yeah.
We were unable to get that because we had to publish for them considerable detail. These other places didn't require any experimental, like, you know, Academy of Science.
So your interest here was to get the idea out in the head of other people.
Yes.
But still, you had to kind of circumvent the patent department.
That's right. It's difficult in industry. And, as I say, in the meantime, there were as many as five others had done similar things, and most of them didn't get good results and quit.
Mm-hmm.
And through no particular wisdom on our part, we'd chosen a better starting place. But Morrison did it by putting a side chain on the thing, and he got 15% something, nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
And then over in France, and this was the first real publication came out, as Cagon did this with the one based on tartaric acid. He was getting exactly similar results to our original one we call CAMP, C-A-M-P.
Mm-hmm.
And his was called DIOP, D-I-O-P. And Cagon came out with his. And he got a communication out a little faster than we did because he was in a university.
How do you spell his last name?
K-A-G-A-N.
Okay.
But he didn't know we existed, and we didn't know he existed.
Okay.
When we got the 80%, it was sometime like in June, and he came out with his in the following winter.
Mm-hmm.
But
so you were basically trying to publish the fact that you were getting these.
There's another thing that was happening at the same time. This shows how much luck there is, and. But it was probably very important. At this time, we were making, the discovery was that L-DOPA was a very good treatment for Parkinson's disease.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you had to have only the L-isomer, the DL-isomer. They started with the DL-isomer, but it took such massive doses that you're feeding the patient a lot of junk that he really didn't need.
Right.
And you were worried about it, what it might do to it.
Because mm-hmm.
they used me originally. Pretty massive doses to get their effects. And so it looked like a fairly big business.
Now, so these doses Monsanto, were mixtures of D and L.
Yeah, this is where Vanlon gets into it. Monsanto was in the custom manufacturing business, and they were custom manufacturing an intermediate for this L-DOPA,
mm-hmm.
and the intermediate was starting with Vanlon. And their motivation was, they told Roche wanted to just buy a Vanlon.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we want more of the act. We've got some idle capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So they made this advanced intermediate with Roche's process.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing this in the Queenie plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we weren't supposed to even know about this, but we'd learned about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that we didn't get good results with our synthesis with simple olefins. We had to do what turned out to be the intermediate in this synthesis, which is inorganic synthesis, pretty standard synthesis called the Erlenmeyer-Aislach-Tone synthesis. It's on page 1, organic 3 of collective volume 3.
Mm-hmm.
And but that olefin worked much better for our kind of synthesis,
mm-hmm.
for our hydrogenations, than anything else. So we had gone over, I should have said earlier, we'd gone over to using that olefin. It was easy to make and everything. And we could make it either from the vanillin derivative, that'd be dihydroxy, or the phenylalanine, which would just be the phenyl, so benzaldehyde. Mm-hmm. So we went ahead and I went out. I tried to find out what was going on in the Queenie plant, because the patent department said, well, it was this Tally's secret. Roche has told us that. And everything. And so we can't tell you what's going on. And I said, well, I believe I know what's going on. And I had organic synthesis, which is the standard checked out synthesis for organic chemistry. And you know, they take the literature and somebody, some professor, confirms that that works. Mm-hmm. So what's an organic synthesis works. And well, on page one, collected volume three, this is certainly my area's lactone synthesis with benzaldehyde. It didn't have. And I said, is this what they're doing? And the guy said, yeah, you mean I signed all these secrecy agreements for something in public domain?
Yeah.
I said, evidently you did. Well, then he was a little more cooperative. Mm. But so much for secrecy. It's a funny thing sometimes. But
yeah, well, I mean, you know, they were just using something everybody else knew. They just didn't want anybody else to know it.
I think you, that's what it is, exactly. But whatever it is, in the Roche intermediate, we could take it and go 80%.
Mm.
And coupled with it, our separations were very easy in the L-DOPA field. We were able to commercialize. So we said, let's stop everything and commercialize this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very good decision on my part, because no one would have criticized me if I hadn't done anything at all. Just kept on working in the field. They wouldn't have said boo.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, well, let's show somebody this works. And no one really believed it worked.
Mm.
And there's nobody in the development department or anything believe we had anything more than just some laboratory gimmick that would just go away.
It was a
and no one really believed it. But then we decided to run it in the 50-gallon scale in the pilot plant.
Mm.
Incidentally, in that reactor, poison, but these things don't poison.
Mm-hmm.
These cyber catalysts have different poisons. They poison, but they don't poison with sulfur.
Mm.
And as soon as we ran the 50-gallon scale, they perked up and said, well, gee, maybe have something that works then. And it was kind of funny, because there were a few people. See, we're still a vanillin. We had the starting material, so Merck
right.
was in talking about vanillin and so forth. And because it has the dihydroxy benzaldehyde, and it's very hard to make that specifically for it, so you almost didn't take any great brain to say that's what you're going to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were in talking, they came into our lab, and people congratulated us. And our people say, what for? But that's the.
I was curious.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, a prophet is not well recognized in his own country or whatever.
You know. What are they congratulating you for?
Your competitors congratulating you. Your chemistry you're doing in your company, Jonah does that in a clue as to what's going on.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Well, that's what happened. But anyhow, in the basic chronologies, you know, we'll get into later, the thing came out that we were at the 50-gallon scale when Calgon came up with his initial communication.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only proof we have we beat him.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were beating by, say, 6 months. That's about what it took for us to get from the laboratory to 50 gallons.
And so eventually, though, did you...
And nobody bothered about it because there isn't much expense then to just put on another man or so and go to the pilot plant. But then after that, we have to find a place to make it. Then you start to spend a little money.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ran into the problem that you talked about, the top brass not being very... cognizant of what's going on. I mean, chemically.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get anybody to back the project.
Mm.
Couldn't get anybody for a while. And just got turned down. Well, we have to spend your time on something more important than that. But then we...
You were trying to sell the brass into doing
going into
L-DOPA production.
Yeah.
and you had a way to do it, and said it would be extremely
put the other out of business. Yeah.
And but this wasn't something they wanted.
They didn't understand it. That was a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then finally, I got a guy named Al Heininger, who was head of a fine chemicals group. He was, I guess, a vice president, and he, because he had a background in chemistry, and instantly understood it, and he'd been involved in the custom manufacture that Roche was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he finally backed it.
So how does he spell his name?
Heininger. H-E-I-N-I-N-G-E-R.
H-E-I-N-I-N-G-E-R. Heininger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he backed it.
So he finally found somebody that that had enough...
Well, that's what you've got to do in a big corporation. You're not welcomed in open arms for discovery. It's a fact of life. It changes their way of doing things. They got all their plans, everything, come up with something. I mean, it changes all their plans.
It's not in the plan, so that's messing up my apple cart.
But it happens that way.
Oh, yeah.
Even it happened a little bit on Monsanto's product Roundup, which is the biggest discovery they ever made in their labs. Mm-hmm. Really, it happened to John Franz who did that. He was a little taken aback when he came up with that, and they said, "What do we want this stuff for?"
Yeah,
I mean that's the first attitude.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Then they finally.
How do you spell his name?
Well,
yep.
Franz, F-R-I-N-Z. He was the inventor of Roundup, but that just happens a little bit.
Well,
he's got something in chemical heritage.
Yeah. So you've got this high performance stable of chemists working for you, and they come up with something, and you say, "What's it? You know, go away." You know, I mean, it's like.
But it's easier to have him come up and say, "You're doing it the right way, and there isn't any better way to do it." That's what they like, because then the businessman likes to deal with the marketplace and stuff like that. He doesn't like to deal with real change, because it does. It upsets everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was I ran into that hydrogenation thing. It was pretty obvious thing to do, but it just upset their all. They had all these schedule plans, and they had groups were skilled in hydrogenations and running those damn autoclaves, and it took a lot of stuff to do it. And it takes a lot to get that to work.
Yeah, you got to. It's like a steamship heading in one direction, and you got to change course, and it's not easy.
Take a new course. That's right.
So. If I understand this correctly, you certainly knew that what you were doing with this asymmetric hydrogenation was important, and it was something that needed to be in the literature. And if you wanted to make sure that you got it in the literature.
That's right.
But the patent department's over here saying, you know...
Well, they always say, wait a minute, you got to at least file a case before you can do that. And they held up the Roundup chemistry a long time because that was very important to them.
Uh-huh.
This was not important to them. This was the only reason I got by with it, because it was a side
issue. So as far as they were concerned, it was an insignificant development. But they had to—they still had to get their patent control.
Yes. Oh, well. And once the patent finally got into it, they were thrilled with the opportunity because it was a unique thing. Most of the stuff is just a little better way to plasticize vinyl or something. And you can endless ad infinitum little minute changes. This is a breakthrough. And they patented the wrong thing. They just patented the use of a chiral phosphine. All chiral phosphines don't work. Only very special. That's stupid. But they didn't look at it that way at all. And they said, you guys will find the right one. And...
So they do have technically competent people in the patent department to look at these things and understand the chemistry.
Oh, yeah.
At least the patent department does.
They did. I don't know if they do now. They Mohawk canned all those people. I don't know whether they got them now, because it's a different ballpark. But that's they must have. But they had competent people that knew enough chemistry to go on. And we had a very competent guy do this. And one thing he was able to do on this one was change the original disclosure. Mm. The original disclosure was on that 15%, you usually only get in a patent the claims. You don't get any more claims than you make in the first application. They chop off claims. You can't have three, you can't have five, you can't have six, but you can't add any more after you once say it.
Mm.
But he went into... The patent department sold his points. The only time he ever did it, this is a pioneering invention. He didn't know what to claim in the beginning.
Mm.
And he was able to add more claims.
But okay, so
he got a whole bunch of claims.
You really have to broaden the claims at the beginning.
They broaden it as much as they possibly can, because they can't get any more. Mm. And this was a unique case. He was able to convince the guy that
that's good.
Do more, but and whatever. This didn't make a lot of money for Monsanto. Made some, but not. But the fact that we commercialized it so quickly attracted the Swedish Academy, because most of the things that they talk about don't get commercialized that fast, and they kind of that. It turns out that if we hadn't done that commercialization, we'd never have been heard.
So it would have been a neat trick in the literature, and that would have been the end of it.
That would have been the end of it, and the Nobel Prize would have gone to Kagan and Noriari and Sharpless. Now that's another thing that happened. This thing got pretty well recognized in the 70s, and everybody found out that yes, we could do it with that. We came up with an improved phosphine later, the 95% efficiency, and everybody else, Japanese, all over the Toronto and England, okay, came up. There were maybe 100 phosphines which would do the same damn job, about the same efficiency, on what we call precursors for alpha amino acids, and nothing else. And that's where it sat at the end of the 70s. Now remember, who was sitting on the stage watching us do all these things, but was too lazy to make phosphines. I don't know, we should pick on Noriari, but he wasn't a synthetic chemist. And he didn't think it was worth the trouble to make phosphines. And he was at Harvard at this time with Osborne, who did invent the Wilkinson thing. And so the thing was all sitting on the pile there for them to be first, but they didn't want to bother to do the synthetic work because it was sloppy, dirty chemistry to make those phosphates.
So this Sabaki fellow was the guy that got the job.
He got the job. Well, then Vineyard came in with me later. We weren't getting too far, and he had nothing to do with this type of chemistry at all, but he came in and said, you need to study the mechanism. And we did a little bit and found out what the stoichiometry was and phosphine and phosphorus and all that stuff, and made a little sense out of the project. But we were wise to go ahead and commercialize it with this not too good catalyst, but good enough for that kind of pharmaceutical, because of the fantastic properties of L-DOPA to crystallize readily. So we were able to do that. A number of phosphines were made during the period of the 70s by all kinds of people. Then the field sort of stalled. I pointed that out in this final write-up. The field stalled until Noriari had come along, and he made a very difficult-to-make phosphine. I don't know why he said it took him 4 years to make it. But he was doing it with slave labor, sort of in graduate schools. And he, in Japan, but anyhow, called BINAP, B-I-N-A-P-H, BINAP, and he just, that turned out to be a leap forward in the field. It could be, particularly was applied to another metal. We knew ruthenium was in the act. We tried to use ours things with ruthenium and weren't doing any good. We'd get hydrogenation, but we didn't get good results. But BINAP gave great results with ruthenium, and so that they ended up exploiting the field, and it burst wide open in the 80s and 90s. And the Japanese commercialized it into a menthol process, a large-scale menthol for about 1980, 82, something like that. About 10 years after DOPA. So we were first to do the initial prototype by a month, and about 6 months on the first good catalyst, and by about 10 years on the commercialization. And And I got the usual awards. Probably the most elegant was the Creative Invention Award from ACS.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 82 or something. We went to Las Vegas and got that. And there was the local company had an award and so forth. And then we were pretty much forgotten. Mm-hmm. There was one award from a catalyst group in 95.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, Sharpless had applied these kind of reactions, catalytic reactions, to oxidations.
Mm-hmm.
Not as beautiful and efficient as hydrogenation, but making much more difficult things. And Sharpless said he was inspired by us. I think that's a fact, because he stated that in his Nobel lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his first spur to drive on when the thing. And Noriari exploited the field with a very large amount of graduate school labor.
Mm-hmm.
And to go to all kinds of structures that we weren't effective on, and mostly using his baby binap, which mm-hmm. is, by his own admission, was kind of hard to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Nobel thing sort of came along a lot later, and I think the first guy they decided they were going to give it to was Sharpless, and then they started looking, and they got Noriari, but there was a Wolf Prize. You know that one? It's an Israeli prize.
No.
That's a fairly big stipend,
mm-hmm.
$100,000 or something like that. And that went to Sharpless, Noriari, and Kagon. That was the winner of 2001. Remember, they got the prize in 2001. That went to them in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The Monsanto community were fuming and said, well, we did that first.
Mm-hmm.
And the prizes are all about getting it first, but mm-hmm. I didn't pay much attention to it. And I'm not sure how the sequence got done. I'm never going to know, because they don't open their books.
Yeah.
But at least the sequence as I know it, there's Corey and Jacobson at Harvard wanted to set the historical record correct. And Corey had sat in with, we were since sold to Pfizer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a consultant for Pfizer, and there's a John Talley that was with us. And I don't know that he had any influence or not. He said this was worth an thing to Corey, and that we did it first.
Mm-hmm.
And this interested Corey, anyhow.
Nice little Corey?
C-O-R-E-Y. He used to be at Illinois, and then he was at Harvard. He's still at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know him well. I've corresponded with him on phosphines, and this was the kind of a thing, field that he was working in a bit. And he did it in a very complicated manner, which wasn't practical.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, he was very interested in making phosphines, and I helped him a little bit on that. But nothing. It was back in 84.
Mm-hmm.
But he called me in the spring of 2001, saying he'd like to get some information for his files. He was getting together about the chronology of this and so mm-hmm. forth. And so I sent him what I had about making the thing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was some inkling, and Talley said what he'd put him up to that. More or less, he'd probably
Talley is spelled
John Talley, was just working in our
TA.
But he'd done a lot of exploiting with the catalysis, made a lot of chemicals that for testing that you wouldn't have bothered to make otherwise. And but this is so easy to do that he did it.
Talley spells last name?
T-A-L-L-E-Y. He isn't with Monsanto anymore. I forget where he went. So that went on. And then I did hear a guy from the Swedish Academy call me. And he said he was doing a review article in the field for the Swedish audience.
Mm.
And wanted some CV data. So I sent it to him and said, oh, I didn't know something afoot, but I didn't really know that. This is in the spring. I pretty much forgot all about it. And he said he'd send me a reprint when they wrote it, but it was going to be in Swedish. It was really for the local audience. And a lot of people do this.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an unknown thing in these little countries that have a lot of research. They want to get something out in the field
mm-hmm.
For them to read. But anyway, that's what he was Per Alberg, he was doing that. And so anyhow, I didn't hear about anything until the phone call, really.
Mm.
And So I don't know what the thing. Per Elberg said they decided by winter that it was going to be me. But it doesn't make sense with what Corey and them, because they didn't do anything until spring.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how the situation worked. But the thing is that the Wolf Prize came out in January, and that was for Noriari and Kagan. And Kagan was, his discovery was made completely unbeknownst to me.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of, I mean, do you have any at all, I mean, you know, suspicion or sense of that there's this consideration going on about the prize for your work? I mean, prior to it, did you have just any inkling of it at all?
Not too much. I heard after the fact, I heard some things, but mm-hmm. I didn't really get much inkling in that. I mean, there were those two things, so at least I knew in the back of my mind I'm either being on the panel to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I knew. But you see, the dilemma was that the actual publication, it's about who's first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I hadn't existed, the field would have been the same place, because Cargon came along and did it, and they did it a little differently, but I'll get that.
Okay.
I bet he didn't answer. I don't know if my wife went out or not.
No, she came back, I think.
Hello? Who? Oh, I'm here. What's this?